You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
As we welcome Matthew Fox to the studio for part two of our conversation on Julian and other topics, let me remind those of you who might not have seen last week's studio that our guest, Matthew Fox, is a theologian, an Episcopal priest, an activist for gender and eco-justice, and an all-around eclectic spiritual leader. He's written 37 books that have been translated into other languages over 70 times. He's contributed much to the rediscovery of the pre-modern mystics and prophets like Julian of Norwich. He holds a doctorate in the history and theology of spirituality from the Catholic Institute of Paris, is the founder of the University of Creation Spirituality in California, and conducts dozens of workshops each year. We're honored and excited to have Matthew Fox joining us again today for part two of our conversation.
Our words of wisdom are from Julian's Revelation of Divine Love, chapter 83. I received inspiration, vision, and feeling regarding three attributes of God. The strength and outcome of the whole revelation rest on these. They are life, love, and light. There is wondrous familiarity in life, a gentle courtesy in love, and an everlasting kindness in light.
I saw these three properties as a single goodness, and I wished with all my might for my consciousness to be joined to that goodness. I pondered what awe that our mind resides in God, and I understand that our ability to think is a gift from God, one that is built into our human nature. This realization filled me with wonder and a sense of sweet harmony. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
I'm curious, of course, to ask you what the response of your classes has been to Julian and so forth, you know. So
the response has been unbelievable. People overwhelmingly have said, where has this woman been all my life?
He's been hiding her from me, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so,
good question.
You know, I've quoted her here and there, like Aquinas or Mechtild or whoever. Mm-hmm. But to do this concentrated focus on Julian, people are really starting to get a feel for her. People have so appreciated her insights, and I have so appreciated the way you have presented it in a way that I can easily plagiarize it for my messages.
So
very, very good. So I was first exposed to your teachings when Original Blessing came out. I actually read it about 30 years ago. Since then, my theology and ministry have never been the same. But I was wondering if you look back almost 40 years ago when it was first published, what would you say the overall impact of the book has been? What's your sense of its legacy over the last 40 years?
Well, you know, with Bishop Spong just dying this weekend, I pulled up an old letter from him that he wrote me in the year 2000. And he begins by saying he first heard of me through Original Blessing. And then he goes on for a couple of paragraphs saying what it did, that it really undid a lot of Christian theology. He said that for centuries, we haven't had another story other than the idea that humanity is totally fallen and needs all this recovery. And Christ on the cross, he said, came to mean Christ the recoverer. But he said that, you know, the Original Blessing, and he said, as I first presented it, and then now he said a lot more people are on board with this, a lot more theologians. He said it's definitely shifted the vision, story of Jesus and why Jesus was here and did what he did and suffered what he did So he said, we didn't have another story for centuries, but this is another story. I know it's been impactful on a lot of people who've told me things like it's kept them in the Christian tradition and so forth. I know it certainly infuriated a lot of the power brokers and the power holders. I couldn't believe the overreaction, to be honest, on the part of the Vatican. The roof blew off. And I remember when the books have been translated into a lot of languages. And when they translated it into Polish, I said, oh, now the Polish Pope will get it. I said, but no, nothing cooled down after it came out in Polish. So what it taught me was what an investment there is in what I would call patriarchal Christianity, in the idea of original sin, even though Jesus never heard of it and no Jews ever heard of it. And that Elie Wiesel said that it's alien to Jewish thinking. I mean, that's really a strong statement. Absolutely. He says, not just not in our Bible, it's alien. You know, it introduces this whole notion that is just inconsistent with Jesus' own understanding. And of course, Jesus never heard of the word either. It's a fourth century term from Augustine. So I think it's shaken up. It's helped some people on a good path, and it certainly has infuriated the right people. As you pointed out, Bishop Spong says that our enemies are more important than our friends.
And I do think that
step on some important, what should I say, red shoes.
Well, that really was really kind of the beginning of the end for you in the Roman Catholic Church.
It was. It was. Although, you know, a lot of Catholics, including priests and theologians, have very much embraced it. But again, it was those who are babysitting the old paradigm,
right,
and calling it church and calling it Christianity, who were infuriated. So it certainly changed my life, but I hope it's changed others, and I hope that it's contributed to the renewal of Christianity and the Christ story and the Jesus teachings. I don't know. I didn't realize it would be as shocking as it was to some people. So maybe my naivete is a blessing.
Well, it certainly has, I know, given people not only the vocabulary to talk about that new paradigm, which I think a lot of people sensed really deep down anyway, but it gave people permission to speak out loud about it. And they had you for cover, which is great.
And me for cover. Okay.
So I'm grateful for that. So thank you.
So I carried their burdens. Remember one a Catholic sister, you may have heard her, Sister Jose Habde, who spent her last years in Tucson. She's also a Seneca woman. She was indigenous. And she told me one day, she said, you know, we Indians, we don't believe in original sin. We can't believe in original sin. Everything nature gives birth to is grace. So what we do when we baptize adults or something, they memorize what the priest wants to hear. So the priest talks about original sin, they nod their head and they give the right answers. But she said, you know, then we get the water on us and the spirit, and that's fine. And we go away and we live our lives again.
Well, it sounds like what a lot of clergy do to get through the Board of Ordained Ministries. Really, exactly. So now that your Julian book has been out for a year, and despite the vaccine, the pandemic continues, what would you want to update about the book or add to, maybe a chapter on the book?
Well, I must say that I deliberately put in the title The Pandemic and Beyond, because I did think we'd be beyond. And certainly when the vaccines came out, and came out so swiftly and effectively, it was like a miracle. But here we are, we've fallen back. Of course, there's new versions of the virus. And so we realize that, you know, that nature is extremely creative. It's not always respectful of the human person. So I suppose, taking up the question that we've alluded to in our discussion here about the capacity of humans to deceive themselves and to listen to lies about vaccines and about presidential elections, and to build entire myths around these. And today it's easier, I guess, with social media and the internet. And I think we all have to get vigilant and get angry, get morally outraged, because that's the energy that is necessary to stand up to folly. It doesn't mean that you get that anger or moral outrage is your primary modality, but it's real. And if we don't do that, people get depressed, or they say, and I've heard a lot of this, people say, oh, it's all over anyway. It's too late. Humanity doesn't have a future. Let's just live, drink, and be merry. There's actually clubs around the country. I've met some of these people. And they meet once a month. It's kind of like church to support one another in the fact that the human race is at an end. And therefore, there's nothing you have to do. And that's what I love about Julia. She's saying, get charged, you know, get charged. Well, that's part of the third chakra. That's part of moral outrage, that fire in the belly about anger. And that's what all the prophets had that. But it's about using that energy, not just to vent, or certainly not to beat up on others, but to create alternatives. And like Gandhi and King and Mandela did, to organize the anger so it becomes something positive and effective. I think that, you know, there's this going on as well as the bad news, that there are a lot of people, and a lot of young people, of course, they're invested in the future to organize, to help give direction to this that is positive. And I think religions stripping down to their essence, which ought to be about love and compassion and justice, this will bring religions together. And the difference is we can celebrate. But today it's about the likenesses. What does Buddhism bring to the picture? What do the indigenous bring to the picture? What do atheists bring to the picture? What do Jews and Christians and others bring to the picture? So let that be our guiding North Star. So I think it's a time of deep ecumenism. And, you know, I think there's a lot of potential.
That's a relief. We've been ending every message of this series reciting Julian's mantra. All will be well, all will be well, all manner of things will be well. And it seems to have made enough impact on folks at the fountains that I'm seeing it pop up in conversations and emails going back and forth among members. What's the attraction of that message for people today?
Well, I think people are looking for hope. And that is certainly a hopeful message. But again, the way I interpret it, and it comes near the end of her book, you see, is that it is relative. This hope is relative. And as I think I cite David Orr, the eco-philosopher, that hope is a verb with the sleeves rolled up. So we're back to that same issue of work, of going to work, of being charged to go to work, to use Julian's language, that her statement is not a passive thing that you can just say, oh, everything's going to be okay, everything's going to be well. It's not that. To me, it's conditional. Things will be well, things will be better if we do our share. And this is the teaching of Rabbi Heschel and anyone else who's really read the Jewish tradition well, and of Jesus too. The Beatitudes don't say everyone will be well, but will be well to the extent that we are true to our simplicity, blessed are the poor spirit, and so forth. So we have to get truer to our own hearts. We have to slim down, I say, strip down what religion is to get to it more to its essence. But what's really being said, I think, is that we have what's necessary to survive, to turn this around. We have the imagination, the creativity, and there's a lot going on that's very hopeful. Just this week, I saw an article about the future of fusion. They've now made a big leap forward regarding fusion. And fusion is so much cheaper and safer than other kinds of energy. The fission. And it could be a real answer to a lot of our energy problems. But even without that, I was with 150 scientists on an island 2 summers ago, and the theme was climate change. And at the end of the week, 2 young scientists stood up, and one said, "We know enough now that we could build an island of windmills 1,000 miles off the northeast, off of New England. No one would see them. They wouldn't be in anybody's backyard. And with the amount of electricity we could pump from those windmills, we could provide all the electrical needs for North America. No coal, no gas or oil needed for that." And another young scientist stood up and said, "If we can quadruple our storage capacity in batteries, and now we've already doubled it, so we only have to double it one more time, all of the Southern Hemisphere, which is, of course, the poorest, it's Africa, Latin America, and Southern Asia, could leap over the fossil fuel situation entirely and get all their needs from the sun. The key is battery storage. And we are making advances in that since that statement 2 years ago. So my point is that, again, humanity's greatness, which is also our shadow side, we're capable of so much evil because we're capable of so much good.
Yeah.
And I think that this whole struggle could, like the dark night of the soul, you learn things there you don't learn anyplace else. So we're learning things about compassion and about our capacities and imaginations and about our values. That's what I mean by stripping down. What are our real values as a species and as a country and as families and communities? Is it about making as much money as we can, or is it about saving our species and our great-grandchildren to come and all this beauty, not just our species, but the others with whom we celebrate this planet? So it is a, it's apocalyptic. Will it be the end of things? Or will it be a revelation of how grown-up Homo sapiens can act? And it will, if that happens, it will be because we've learned the kind of teachings that Jesus and Isaiah and Buddha and Lao Tzu and others have taught, and that is that we're capable of compassion, like God is, and we're capable of this love, and we can carry on only if we can tap into those deep wells of creativity and love and passion and compassion and be charged with it to go to work, as Julian says.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.